It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Sorry about that. Did we have a bunch of dead air? Amy, did we have a bunch of dead air? Anyway, sorry about that for the dead air, guys. Anyway, good to have you guys here. I'm excited because Mary King is here. And Mary King, as you guys know, is the IRS problem-solving attorney. We haven't had her on the show for a while because she was scheduled to be on like a couple of weeks ago, but I had something come up, and we had to do a tape show. And anyway, so good show lined up for you today. We're going to get started here with Mary King. And Mary King is, as I mentioned earlier, she's not only a regular contributor, but she is known as the IRS problem-solving attorney, co-author of the best-selling book, Protect and Defend. Mary's illustrious career started as an attorney, began in 1993 after graduating from Stetson University College of Law. Her career in law has primarily focused in IRS problem solving as well as mortgage foreclosure defense. Mary King has been practicing law for over 19 years and really enjoys helping her clients remove the dark cloud of the IRS. Mary King, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert. It's always great to be here.
Absolutely. I mean, we get to help a bunch of folks out today who are probably not thinking about the IRS, but before we know it, it's going to be tax season is going to be upon us very shortly after the holiday. So we get to party really hard, and all of a sudden, slap, it's time to come up to the IRS reality. And so it's good to have you here. And I want to talk about this. I want to talk about some of the myths for wage reporting, because we have a lot of entrepreneurs, business owners, managers. So start us off with that, myths of wage reporting.
All right. Well, the first one is about the Affordable Care Act. And when you are part of the Affordable Care Act, as an employer, you need to file Form 1095. And for some reason, there's a lot of people who are either unaware of it or they don't know. But the Form 1095 is a required form for tax year 2015. That's the first one.
Yeah, okay.
The other one is the Forms 1099 that employers also send out need to be printed in red ink. I guess people think that they can be printed in black ink, but there is an actual requirement by the IRS that they print out the form in red ink, and I know that sounds silly, but you know that's the way it is.
All right, wait. So for years, you know, because it's interesting, because for years, we've always been told that red ink is kind of a no-no, but this has to be, this particular form has to be done in
red ink, correct?
Wow.
And
okay.
And actually, they will not process it if it's not in red ink.
Gotcha. Okay.
Don't ask me why. Okay.
Talk about it. You know, now we I guess we're really getting into the there's got to be some joke about red ink and red tape. I mean, seriously, we're getting down to the ridiculous here. Okay, red ink. Go ahead.
Right. Okay. So then the next one has to do with our employees or workers. W-2 employees where the employer takes out tax, or are they independent contractors? And, you know, I've seen this a lot where someone comes in and they say, oh, well, my employer has been paying me as a 1099, and they're not taking taxes out, and I didn't understand what that would do, and I'm really a W-2. I should be a W-2 employee and get my taxes taken out. And, you know, a lot of employers, they don't want to pay as a W-2 because then they have to pay the payroll taxes.
Right.
So there are quite a few rules about you know, if you're an employee or if you're an independent contractor. And so it's really an important distinction, and it comes down to a couple things, but the most important one is, you know, does your employer tell you what time to come to work, what time to go to lunch, what, you know, what jobs to do? If that's the case, and this is really very general, but then you're probably an actual employee, and the employer should be taking taxes out. If they just say, hey, you know, you can come in whenever you want, you can do whatever you want, you can dress however you want, then that's more of a, the employee has more freedom of their employment, and they may be a 1099. But there are a number of rules about that, and you have to be sure which category you're in.
Yes, and I do want to point out here that you really need to verify this. Because there, as you said, there are specific rules, and so if you have questions, definitely check with, you know, your tax expert or call Mary on this one. But anyway, go ahead, go on.
Okay, so when you have multiple forms 1099, you also have to file a form 1096. So, for instance, if you have a number of forms, for instance, 1099 interest forms. And those usually come, you know, from banks or from brokerage houses or those kind of things. They would also have to file a separate form 1096 for each group of those 1099, they're called 1099 INTs. So, for instance, if someone was submitting these form 1099 INTs to 10 people, they would file one form 1096 with those.
If you have a bunch of 1099s, you need the 1096?
Right. You have, actually, it's like a summary form. And so you would file the 1096 as well.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. All right. Any other myths? Any other little...
Those are the most important ones.
Great. All right. So let's talk about this, because I heard that this happens quite often. So maybe you got notice that you have an audit coming up. So what are ways to handle short time frame audits? Give us kind of your strategy on this.
Okay. Well, recently the IRS has been sending out notices, examination letters, if you want to call them that, that sets very short limits for taxpayers to contact them and provide the documents that are requested in the letters. In some cases, it's only 15 days for them to provide a response. So if you change your address, if you're out of town, you know, if something happens and you don't get that letter in a timely manner and respond, then the case could be closed and the IRS could say, okay, you owe us an extra, you know, $10,000, $15,000. And then the next bill you'll get is, or the next notice you'll get is, a bill saying you owe us this amount of money. So when you get one of these letters, it's really important, and I can't stress this enough, to contact the person on the notice and schedule an appointment time. And then, of course, also start immediately gathering the documents that are requested. And you can also ask the examiner for an extension of time and say, you know, well, I really need, you know, an extra 20, 30, whatever days to get the documents together. But as long as you contact them and schedule an appointment, you should, you know, they won't issue a notice saying you owe us X amount.
Now, you know, I want to mention this. I want to get your opinion on this. The IRS, for the most part, whether you're an attorney or a layperson, just a regular old consumer, they seem to be fairly, I don't want to say, maybe the word is easy. I want to say they are fairly easy to work with. As long as you contact them, as long as you explain your situation, they're not unreasonable, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Would that be your experience? What do you think?
That's correct. I mean, as long as you contact them, if they send you a notice and you contact them and say, hey, I got your notice, you know, let's schedule an appointment, but I need an extra amount of time. As long as you make that contact and they don't think that you're ignoring them, It's when you don't contact them, you make an appointment, you don't show, those kind of things when they get more aggressive.
Of course, I am not by any means a IRS expert here, but no showing the IRS, you better have a really good reason, because these are the wrong people not to show for, right? I mean, this is they have a lot of powers, and let me tell you, it can quickly get out of hand if you decide not to show for the IRS. Anyway, go ahead.
You're absolutely correct about that, and that is another important point. Let's say that you do schedule an appointment, you don't show, you don't call them and say, hey, I need to reschedule. What will happen is they will just assess you that amount of money that they think you owe, another bad scenario is they will say, fine, you didn't come and talk to us about this year, now we're going to open up two more years and look at those years. Right. So it can go from bad to worse, like you said, really quickly.
Yeah, man, I love it. All right. You know what? Let me ask you about this.
Can I just say one more thing
ahead.
About that?
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you don't or appear for the appointment, or you don't provide any documents or whatever the situation is, and they assess you that amount of money, you have two choices. Choice A, pay whatever they say you owe, or file a petition in tax court. You can't just, appeal and say, hey, wait a minute, I was still needing time to get my documents together, whatever the situation is. You have to actually, you have very limited options at that point.
Gotcha. Yes. All right. So you ready for my next question?
I am. Go ahead.
Okay. So, all right, I love it. All right. So every now and then, people are fortunate enough to get certain debts, if you will, forgiven or canceled. Does that create a taxable event?
It does. And actually, for instance, if you have a foreclosure or a repossession, or you get a credit card, canceled and the debt settled, anything like that, you should, you don't always, but you should receive a form 1099-C, which is a cancellation of debt form. That form is not only sent to you, but it's also sent to the IRS. And what happens is, and I know it sounds sort of contradictory, but any canceled debt is considered ordinary income, and that must be shown on your form 1040, your tax return.
I'm sorry. It's very irritating. Hey, we're gonna forgive that debt. You couldn't pay for your house, so we're gonna forgive that $100,000, the whatever debt you owe to your house. But we got to fill out this form that creates a $100,000 taxable event. It just seems, the reason why to me it doesn't make sense is because you're not getting to keep the house.
Right. Right.
I mean, so how, anyway, so obviously this is not the time to get into it, but it doesn't make sense in a scenario like that. Now, to me, where it does make sense is if you owed, you mentioned credit card, or let's say a bunch of medical bills, where you received the value, you received the goods, and then they're forgiving or canceling the debt. You were made better. You receive value. So, yeah, to me that makes sense. You should pay your taxable income on that because, you got something for nothing, and that's not the way we work. But when it's all air, I mean, again, with the foreclosure, they forgive the $100,000 that you owe even though you got kicked out of the house. Anyway, that doesn't make sense. But this is very interesting because a lot of people think, hey, I got my debt forgiven. I shouldn't owe anything. It does create a taxable event. Now, the person, from what it sounds like, the person on the other end who actually forgave the debt may or may not report it because maybe they don't know they're supposed to, right?
Well, that's the first thing. But there's also, during the foreclosure crisis, there was a lot of banks or lenders that were not, for whatever reason, were not issuing the Form 1099-Cs. And I've talked to a number of people, and we all can't figure out, what's going on. But that did happen. Additionally, there was an exclusion for a certain amount of time that would exclude a certain amount of the debt on a foreclosure. That has expired. I don't know if they'll bring it back, but probably not, because, I mean, most areas of the country now aren't seeing the horrible foreclosure mess that we were seeing before. But, yeah, it does to me, it is a little confusing about the whole canceled debt thing. But, you know, it is part of the IRS code, and so we have to just go with it.
Yeah, yeah, that's currently the rules. Now, again, like I said, unfortunately, we don't have enough time to talk about it. I'm the kind of guy who would fight it. If all of a sudden you got a foreclosure, what form was that? Something C?
1099-C.
1099-C, and they're saying, hey, we forgave your $100,000 foreclosure debt. I'm the kind of guy who would fight that. I wouldn't fight it on my own, by the way. I would definitely hire somebody like Mary or, you know, your tax expert to help you out. Anyway, but like I said, that's for another time. Mary, I want to wish you the happiest of holidays. Looking forward to hanging out with you next year. Mary King Esquire, the IRS problem-solving attorney. Always good to have you, and look forward to speaking with you soon.
Thanks, Bert. Have a great holiday as well.
All righty. We're off and running. Good stuff there from Mary King, the IRS problem-solving attorney. If you have questions, you want to reach out to Mary, and she'll answer your questions for free. You can check her out at taxlawyerflorida.com, taxlawyerflorida.com. She'll answer your question. She helps clients like myself across the nation, so no problem. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we're back. My next guest, the CEO of Costlow, Devin Koskin. Devin Koskin is here to help us with the car buying process. One of the weirdest, most hated, most frustrating process in the world. Devin Koskin, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you for having me, Bert. I'm glad to be here.
All right, so let's talk about this. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your background in this space.
So I actually come from the wholesale industry. I've been in the wholesale industry for quite a few years, but Costlow came about just with the frustration with the car buying process, always thinking that there was an easier way than the current processes was out there. So I didn't have a lot of experience in the car dealership. I had quite a few friends and associates that I'd worked with that had experience in it. So, but from my wholesaling industry, that's where the business side of it came, and kind of the inner workings of our system, a lot of it came from my experiences in that industry.
All right. So what's your take? Why do we hate the car buying process?
I think it's the big thing is just the time and money it takes to do the car buying process. If you go to a car dealership, a lot of them now are no haggle pricing. So you could see a price on an item that's at your local dealership, and they won't negotiate pricing with you. And then you jump online and you see the same vehicle for $3,000, $5,000 less. So I think the time it takes just to go to multiple dealerships and then the lack of buying power as one person. If I'm buying 100 vehicles, obviously I'm going to get better pricing. But me as an individual just going to a dealership, I don't have any power to negotiate. And also just the buying online process, you have multiple sites out there and you can find the best price on that site, but you know you're limited to only the vendors that have their items listed on that site. So then you find yourself going to multiple sites trying to compare what's the best price and coupling that with going to dealerships. And it's just to me it was just a very overwhelming process that it just, you never know. You always have buyer's remorse, I feel like, after you buy a vehicle, because you don't know if there was something better out there because you only have so much time you can invest in the purchasing process.
And I think that's right. And on top of that, there's just so many ways it seems like a car dealership is there to get you. I mean, even if you think you got the car for a good price and, you know, you've checked it on, you know, you checked it online, you know, then there's the little nickel and dime stuff like the dock prep fee and the car prep fee. And, you know, and then if you finance through the dealer, there's, you know, there's all these additional little things here. And before you know it, you, like you said, you walk out of there and you're just like, did I or did I not get screwed?
Correct. Yep.
All right. So let's talk about Koslo and tell me, how do consumers benefit from, you know, from using Koslo?
Yeah, so essentially how Koslo works is a customer just comes to us and they enter in exactly what they want. So if they're looking for a Chevy Tahoe or whatever it may be, they put the specifics, the year, the make, the model, the mileage they're looking for, all the features, if they want leather, sunroof, things like that. They put everything that they want in, and essentially from there they just click submit and our system does the rest. Our system then, like I said, if they're looking for Chevy, we have all of our vendors who have signed up that are Chevy dealers. So let's say we have 200 Chevy dealers across the United States signed up with us. That bid goes to all 200 Chevy dealers. If the those vendors have that car on the lot that matches it, they submit a bid. If they don't, they simply just decline the bid. But we use the mass of numbers to try to get the customer the best price by having multiple people bidding on the same thing. So from there, we take the top 20 by price and matching their criteria. And then we also add in shipping if the customer desires it, where we negotiate shipping on those top 20 items. And then we take the top five combined price and shipping and give it to the consumer. So once they've submitted it, within 24 hours, we have the best five prices across the country with shipping to their doorstep. So it just saves them so much more time that all they do is submit it, and within 24 hours, we have the best five results to their doorstep. So I think for me, that would solve a lot of my problems of doing a lot of that investigation, looking online, seeing if I'm finding the best prices. It just simply gives them the top five that would show up at their doorstep a couple days later.
All right. This is really cool. So this is like LendingTree, but for cars, right? Where, again, you send it out for bid. All of a sudden, you have people who are bidding to get your business.
Correct.
Wonderful. Unlike something like Auto Trader, which gives you features and spec information, and you know, they're not really, you know, they gives you, you know, Auto Trader would kind of be like a research tool more than anything else, but Koslo is really about getting the best price on a vehicle.
Correct. And so there is that part that a lot of people like is actually test driving a car. So,
right.
And we understand that. So something that we do is the vendor has to add pictures. To submit a bid, they have to add pictures, and they also have to submit a Carfax report. So when the consumer gets those top five results, yes, they haven't driven the car, but they have the Carfax report right there they can look through. They have pictures, you know, so they have confidence when they're selecting that item that they're getting the car that they want for the right price.
And depending on the investment you're making in that vehicle, it might be worth, you know, maybe you fly out, or you go to check out these cars. Again, depending on the investment you're making, if you're buying a domestic car and it's it's $10,000-$15,000, might not be worth a trip out there. You're buying a luxury vehicle where you're going to be plunking down $50,000 or $60,000 on a used vehicle, it might be worth your time to fly out there and give it a road test. Let me ask you this: I want to think that dealerships probably did not appreciate this kind of bidding system. How did the dealerships react to this?
So we're still in our vendor campaign, getting vendors signed up. I mean, there's been a mixed bag on this. So the benefit we add to vendors is, so a lot of the sites out there, they have to have API integration where they have to link the systems together. They have to maintain their inventory. If they sell an item, they have to take it off, obviously. If they have new cars come on their lot, they have to put them on. With our system, they simply just have to tell us what brands they sell, and when we get requests, we send them. The other piece is they could cut down on their marketing expense because we're bringing them leads constantly. So instead of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in a local market or trying to get outside your market on TV and radio ads, they could simply scale that back and we will bring them leads. So there is a lot of benefits to it. And the biggest benefit to them is that they don't pay for a lead. They don't pay for anything unless the customer selects their car. So through the entire process, the customer or the vendor does not pay a penny to anyone until the customer has selected their item out of the top five we've given them. So they're paying right now $50 to $100 per lead just if someone clicks on their item online. And that's not a guaranteed sale. Now, ours isn't a 100% guaranteed, but it's the best guarantee out there because we've done the negotiating and the customer has picked from the top five the exact car they want. So there's a pretty good, in our opinion, there'll be a very, very good close rate on those items, and that's the only time the vendor will pay for anything is when the customer's actually selected their item.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know any business person that wouldn't want that deal.
Correct.
If you can bring me a bunch of warm leads that are 80% ready to go, whatever, I'll do that all day long, right? So as a car dealership, you got to be pretty excited about this. You may not make as much margin on it, but you're not, as you said, you're not spending as much on advertising. This is something that's, being handed to you. 80% ready to go. It's not a bad deal.
Exactly, yes.
And, what's interesting to me is that I remember when eBay started selling cars, and a lot of people were just watching eBay to see how well they did. And eBay's done very well moving cars across the nation without test driving them, just between videos and photos and talking to the seller. So to me, I think that the time is kind of right. I think more and more people are used to buying cars without test driving them. I think that it's, test driving isn't the big deal that it used to be. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I would agree. I think as the years go on and as the internet, more people turn to the internet, I would agree with you. I mean, I think the older generation, you still see that where they'd like to see it, touch it. But as a newer generation and people get more and more accustomed to buying everything online, I agree with you that the test drive is becoming less and less important. So I think, like you said, I think the market is ripe for a company like Koslo to come in and do the negotiations and get the customer the best price and bring it right to their doorstep.
Absolutely. And guys, if you want to check out the website, it's Koslo, spelled K-O-S, as in Devin's last name, I'm assuming.
Correct. Yep.
Good job. So it's KOSLO, Koslo. And so I think it's worth going out there and checking out. I was on their website, and it's fairly easy to navigate. You won't have any problems. Now, I forgot to ask you this. So if I go on there, does it cost me anything to look for a car, or does it just cost the dealership? How is the consumer charged, if any?
Yeah, the consumer doesn't pay a penny for this service. So it's just simply the vendor pays for the lead once the customer selects which car they want. So it doesn't cost the consumer a penny.
Devin Koslow, it's been a blast having you on the show. I'm excited about your new venture. I'd love to bring you back in a few months and give us an update on how you guys are doing. Good having you on the show. Look forward to speaking with you down the road.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Bert. I appreciate your time, and thanks for having me.
You bet.
All
good
right,
stuff
care.
There. I love innovation. How come, you know, here's the thing. This is one of those things that makes so much sense, doesn't it? Where's the, you know, so now that you've heard this concept, you're probably thinking like I am, why didn't somebody think of this earlier, sooner? This is where innovation, this is where sometimes the old saying is true. You're so close to the trees, you can't see the forest. This would have been a perfect thing for somebody like Auto Trader or Kelley Blue Book or somebody along those lines to have done. But Devin Koskin and his team had that moment and they went for it. And, you know, now they're working with hundreds of dealerships, bringing consumers a better buying experience. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool. You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, who's next?
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All righty. We are back. My next guest, Christine Duvier. Christine Duvier mentors innovators to get the results, relationships, and happiness they want. Christine unleashes talents. I'm sorry. My screen, my teleprompter starts blinking on me, and it messes up my ability to introduce people intelligently. So, but anyway, let's go back. Let's try it again. Christine unleashes talent, squelches in school and work to create inspired work, life, and well-being. Christine started her career as a Cornell MBA, where she ignored traditional to lead a radical change and ignite passionate commitment in global customers and employees, and then went on to work with other leaders for the past 17 years. Christine Duvier, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert. I'm delighted to be here.
All right, so let me ask you this. Here you are. You're here in Cornell. You're going through their MBA program. And what did you see? What made you start ignoring these traditional methods that led you to the way you do business?
Thanks for that question. That's a good one. I guess what happened was, you know, as I got into business, first I was in accounting and then finance, and I would just see that the way, and I was in these really large companies, given what I'm about to say, I won't name them at the moment, but I was in these really great companies. They're actually really great, innovative, huge companies that have been very successful. But I would see, I would be in these different pockets, and I would see that the way we were doing things, we really weren't focused enough on sort of starting with the customer and the results the customer wants and then sort of backing into how we do things. And, you know, so I was just aware of that this was an issue and that that's more of what I wanted. And I also just kind of saw that, you know, in the history of at least, you know, a couple of the companies I've been part of, what I loved about them, and I can name a couple of them for this reason, like DuPont and Eli Lilly, I mean, they were really great with their people, right? And so you could just sort of see that especially entrepreneurial companies and then companies that really sort of built a big presence for themselves were wonderful about engaging their employees and caring about employees and customers. But then companies can kind of lose sight of that over time. The other thing that was happening was I was sort of seeing what was going on with the Japanese and other, you know, Koreans and other countries. And so I just realized we had to do something different. And so when I began learning, like, what were some of the different things that were happening, that got me really excited. But it was not traditional business, and it wasn't a traditional career path, as I was told many times.
Well, you know what, and it's interesting to me because some of these old, you know, older established companies who are inflexible, eventually sometimes they disappear. I mean, Kodak was this monster leader. They at one point, Christine, you probably know this, but at one point they owned all of the patents in the digital industry for digital camera and all that stuff. They owned all those patents, and they just didn't know what to do with them. They fought it. They who knows what was happening in their boardroom where, you know, here you are, you literally own the patent for the next evolution of photography, but you are so traditional, you're so closed-minded or stubborn or whatever words you want to use, that you don't do anything with it. And you literally just die on the vine.
Yeah, I know.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I know, it is.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, so you started your career again as an MBA, and that led change in these Fortune companies that you work with, these Fortune 50 companies, and then you started working with leaders all over the world. How did you end up studying young adults? What shifted that you realized, okay, this is where I'm going to focus?
Yeah, well, a couple things happened and came together. So first of all, I began working with leaders, bringing this sort of positive approach to change to smaller, more entrepreneurial businesses and, you know, mid-sized businesses. And so one icy February morning, I'm sitting in my office, you know, huddled over my computer, kind of going through deleting these old emails, you know, click, delete, click, delete, click, and then I decide to open one, and it was for a master in positive psychology. Brand new field, and it was one of those moments where, you know, again, I don't go with the tradition a lot of times. It was just like, yes, I have to be part of this. I have to go study with the founders of this field, because it was kind of what I'd been doing and studying on my own, but there had never been a field where I could actually, like, study the sciences. So that came together. So that was one piece of it. But the other piece that really changed my trajectory was a tragedy. And so, you know, as part of this master's program, I had to do research. And I'll never forget, there was a sunny spring afternoon in my car. I pick up the phone, and I hear, "Mom, Mom, Mom." And it's my daughter, Lauren, who is a senior in high school. And I'm like, "Lauren, I can't understand what you're saying." She's like, "Mom, Sam, suicide."
Mm.
And, all the air was just sucked right out of me. And so those two pieces came together at that moment. And I knew Sam. He was an amazing kid. But he was the only boy in our high school. They were seniors. He was the only senior that year that wasn't going to go to college. He didn't want to. You know, when I learned more about him, I knew him a little. And, you know, he just really was a great kid. But I found out, you know, he didn't like school, but he had these amazing leadership qualities. And so I just decided, as kind of a cathartic exercise, I'm going to look at kids like Sam. I'm going to look at what are their gifts and their strengths and, like, what's possible for them. And so that's how it came to be that I looked at young adults.
Wow. Wow. And you know what? And sometimes at a tragedy, you know, that's sometimes what inspires people. All right. So let's talk about this real quick, because you've identified some elements that you call the myths of education. What are they, and why do you call them myths?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good question. So these are three myths that I identified through doing my research, and basically they are three principles that most people believe are true, but they're not. And so the first one is this idea that if you're not a good student, you are doomed. There's something wrong with you, you're lazy, you're going nowhere in life. The second myth is if you are a great student, you will have life. And that is a myth, but most people around us believe it. And the third is that our approach to education is actually healthy for most teens. And what I found is that that is not the case. So that's why I call them myths. They're actually inaccurate, but most people believe them. And I did. I always did until I, you know, did this study.
Yes, and it's interesting. You know, I remember in, I think it was high school, we did this test, and I've never been mechanically minded, right? My wife has a set of tools, and when something goes wrong around the house, that's the person who, you know, who fixes the toilet and stuff like that. I'm just, you know, mechanically, you know, I just don't speak tools. But I remember taking this this testing in high school, and they came back, and based on this testing, they said that I would be a real good fit for a boiler mechanic, a boiler room mechanic.
Wow.
And my wife and I, my mom and I looked at this, and they said, obviously, these people are jacked up because this is so goofy. A, I have no mechanical interest. And this was based on the fact that I had good hand coordination and I could assemble things and stuff like that. But I did not score well with mathematics for whatever reason. In a lot of the science areas, I did well, but mathematically, there was a lost connection there. And so because I scored poorly mathematically, they said, hey, this guy is going to be a boiler room mechanic, which had no interest. But it goes back to what you were saying, you know, that we have these, you know, I think that the system – the government, the school system is trying to figure out how do we pigeonhole everybody? How do we put everybody into some kind of category, label them, so therefore we can work with them? And the reality is that first of all, you can't do that. Maybe you can do that with 40 or 50 or 60% of the classroom, but there's going to be a large percentage of the classroom that doesn't necessarily fit any specific label. And so I think you're right about this myth that, you know, if you score well in school, you'll do well in life. That's not true. I think, and I don't know if this is true or not, this may be a myth as well, but Albert Einstein did poorly in school, but we know that he achieved many great things. So
yes, that is true, actually.
Okay. All right. Well, good. So let me ask you this. So how do we go about developing future leaders even when they're, quote, not the top students?
Yeah, thanks for that. Great question. So there's a couple of things that I think about. And first of all, I want to just mention to you, Bert, that as you already know, but some people listening may not, when I did my study, I was looking at the bottom 80% of the class. So that is the vast majority of the class. And the interesting thing is that since I've done that, people and young adults that are in the top 20% are coming my way. So it's really interesting. It affects many more kids than we would think about. But to your point about developing future leaders, there's a couple of things I think about. I mean, the first thing that I talk to people about and that clients I work with, we think about is that you want to be focusing on what I call the gifts that conflict with school. So in other words, these are things that are great about individuals that are actually in conflict with what's being asked of them in school. And so it's kind of the, you know, the round hole square peg thing.
Right.
Where what we're asking kids to do is the hole, the round hole, but they're more of a square peg, and it's just not fitting. But instead of thinking that that means there's something wrong with this kid or this young adult, it's actually that there's something really amazing, a gift that's incredible or a strength that's incredible in them that just isn't a fit with what they're being asked for. So, you know, that's the first thing, is just to start recognizing their gifts and their strengths. I also, you know, one of the things I make really clear when I talk or write about any of this is that we're talking about a system here, and the system of the school and the government is put in place by all of us in society. So, you know, most people want to go change the school, but the school reflects the community around it. So we have to look at how we want to educate our children differently if we want that to change. And then the other piece is, so for companies, so, you know, I do a lot of work with these leading-edge, technology-oriented, very highly skilled kinds of companies and even organizations, right, even medical organizations, for example. And, you know, one of the things I started hearing from them was, oh, we have a quote-unquote talent shortage coming. Well, they only have a talent shortage if they are thinking that the only places they can recruit are MIT, Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, University of Tokyo, you know, whatever the Indian equivalent of that is. And that's just not the case. You know, you would miss the Albert Einsteins of the world and many, the guy that created, you know, was one of the instrumental people in the Human Genome Project, Bill Dreyer. You know, you'd miss some of those people if you're simply looking at their grades or even test scores. So that's the other piece of it, is that for companies, and I've heard some great stories about the old Bell Labs, where they would actually, like, grab a kid that they heard about in high school who was inventing, you know, call waiting or call forwarding on his home phone just for the fun of it. He was a terrible student, right? And they'd grab him and pull him into their research lab. You know, so things like that are ways that we can start developing our future leaders.
You know, this is my favorite phrase, I think, of all year. The gifts that conflict with school. I mean, to me, that says it right there. For if you're a parent of a child who maybe is not conforming to the norms of school, maybe that's the gift, you know, that's a gifted child, but just not gifted in that, quote, traditional way.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
What I just love that phrase. The gifts that conflict with school. And but you know what? And you can expand that, to, you know, so, you know, because we see people who are gifted and their gifts conflict with, quote, society norms. Lady Gaga is one of my favorite people to look at because she's outrageous, outlandish, you know, kind of in that Madonna tradition that, you know, she makes these bold, weird statements that conflict with, quote, society norms. But yet she's very talented, and she's not only a songwriter or a singer, but she's also into acting and writing, and she's got causes that she cares about. I couldn't name a song, but I like, you know, I like kind of what, you know, I like it when people stand out and they kind of follow their own path, and I love this idea of gifts that conflict with school. That should be a T-shirt worn by every person in the world. And I like this other idea of the fact that the school is a sum total of the community, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, thanks for that. And I love Lady Gaga, too, for all the reasons you mentioned and for her music. But, yeah, you know, innovators are never, like, following the norm and the tradition, right? They're always thinking differently. And, yeah, you're absolutely right about that, Bert.
Yeah, I love it. You know what, Christine, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back and talk more about you know, I guess for lack of better terms, the weirdness that we all have, and I'd love to bring it back and talk about how to motivate children and how to deal with employees and stuff like that, and have you back as soon as possible.
That would be great. I'd love to do that, Bert.
All right.
Enjoyed our time together.
Absolutely. Good stuff there from Christine Duvier, and you can find out more about her at Christine Duvier, DUVIVIER.com. I just love that. The gifts that conflict with school, many of us can relate to that. A lot of us, like myself, just kind of had an aha moment, right? The gifts that conflict with school. What a wonderful way of phrasing that. Thank you, Christine. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
We are back. My next guest, Kim McDaniel. Kim McDaniel is a former U.S. Army captain, full-time hero in my opinion. she was trained to motivate, lead, and serve. After leaving the military, she chose to be a stay-home mom and homeschool her children. Let me tell you, man, talk about being a full-time hero. So she did that for 12 years. During this journey, she found many opportunities to not only connect with and educate her children, but they also taught her the joy of educating, exploring, and growing. Following her bent to teach and empower, she became a certified holistic life coach and now owns and operates wellness studio in Baltimore called Rejuvenation Spot. The place people go to feel better. Retired U.S. Army Captain Kim McDaniel, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Well, thank you so much, Bert. I'm glad to meet the boiler operator that would not be.
That's right. The boiler room mechanic that would not be. Well, you know, first of all, I do want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for serving our country. That is something that I feel very honored, that you did that and very proud that you took time out of your life to serve our country. So thank you very much.
My absolute privilege. Trust me.
Okay. All right. So let's jump into this because this is a great journey. You go from being a U.S. captain to, a stay-home mom, which in itself is a tough job, to homeschooling your children, which I think is, takes that up to another notch. What happened? What made you want to go and start homeschooling your kids?
I will say that it's very interesting. This is just a terrific segue from the previous guest that you had, because I recognize that their gifts and talents probably would not be maximized, may not even have been introduced to them. So we had a chance to figure out what those would be early on, and we got a chance to not only accelerate, but, really focus on them. I'll just give you one example. My son, at a very young age, decided he liked not only swimming but scuba diving, and he was scuba certified, by the time he was 10. So it was, the little joys like that where I knew I would never be able to break away from the crowd to do that, because we would have to be focused only on reading, writing, and arithmetic in a regular schoolroom setting. So I have, tons of stories like that with myself and the other families that I united with as a homeschooling mom. And I wouldn't trade a thing, Bert. It was awesome.
Well, I, again, my hat's off to you. I thought about that several times, but then I chickened out. I just thought, I don't want it. It's just a lot of work, and you know, I was the main breadwinner. So, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, I couldn't do both. But what a great way to really, as we mentioned in the intro, connect with your kids. I mean, but at the same time, I gotta ask you this. Here you are, you're a stay home mom / you know, a homeschooler. So you were literally, you lived out of your house. I mean, literally, you were there all the time, 24/7. It sounds like.
I lived out of my house, but I also had an entrepreneurial bug. So early on, I did think, and let me just say this as well. So when you say, and other people have said to me as well, that homeschooling might be too overwhelming, it always matters if you can enlist the help of the community. One example,
yes.
I'm not a seamstress. I do not sew at all. But I had someone in my circle who was, and I would take that my child to their house, and they taught my child how to sew. So there are many things like that that would help me and embrace my journey and have people invest along the way with you that made it exciting. So when your child crosses the finish line, you got a whole team of people behind them saying, hey, I was part of that. And I will say, too, that a lot of times people look at homeschooling and they look at it as a sacrifice. And I'm helping people to understand the difference between sacrifice and investment. And I rarely use the word sacrifice anymore because I realize that what I'm putting in is minuscule compared to what comes out at the other end. So that's part of, you know, that's part of the journey. And, you know, my kids, I remember my oldest child went to college. She stepped on the campus and she told me this afterwards, she literally thought in her mind, oh, my gosh, did my mom really teach me everything I need to know? Will I be able to compete? And she just got her, you know, her BFA last year. So, you know, thank God she had an amazing journey. But same thing. You know, I had one mom who told me, like, maybe fourth grade, she's at a library event and all the kids start writing and she looks down and she's like, oh, my gosh, my child doesn't know how to write in cursive. I forgot to teach them that, you know. But that's not a make or break thing in the big picture of life, you know.
Well, and the reality is, I think most of us get away from cursive writing anyway. I think it's a lost, I don't know if it's even a lost art. It's just a lost technology. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, my writing cursive and your writing cursive might be day and night, right? I mean, you might have
exactly.
Great handwriting when it comes to cursive writing, and maybe I don't. We've seen people who really are great scribblers. And they really should not be allowed to ever write in cursive. You can barely understand them when they write, you know, with print. And so I think that, you know, as you said, writing in cursive is not a huge thing. But, you know, some people may kind of raise an eyebrow about that. All right. So let's talk about this. You know, tell me a little bit about the wellness facility that you started and you run, the revenue.
Rejuvenation.
For some reason, my English Spanish is not separating well enough or something. But anyway, so yes, all right, where people go to feel better. Go ahead, tell me about your spot.
Wonderful. It is a holistic spot. It's a wellness studio. And again, taking into consideration the whole mind, body and spirit balance, you know, kind of a tripod, if you will. So at my location, I do everything from life coaching, holistic health coaching, weight management, pain relief, aromatherapy, just empowering people and helping them to understand that they have actual permission and authority to go inside to tap into their greatness. And I think a lot of people are kind of running around with shackles, you know, on their feet and not really believing in themselves. And sometimes you just need that support and that permission and that excitement and that, you know, if you're looking at someone crossing, you know, a thin bridge and you look and you say, well, they made it. Well, maybe I can too. So I'm the person who runs alongside them and, you know, gives them the tools that they actually already have, you know, but gives them the authority to access those tools so that they can be successful in their own life course, their own life journey, and to do it as holistically as possible without the, you know, artificial stimulants and the external prompts, if you will.
Right. Right. You know, and it's interesting, as you said, a lot of time we already have these tools or these abilities within us, but we're afraid. They've been previously made fun of, or for whatever reason they haven't developed these talents, and so they're a little awkward using them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's part of one of the things that you just spoke on, talking about you know, people doing things unconventionally and what looks weird. You kind of have to push past that, and you only push past that if you get used to doing it. You know, so the first time it's very awkward, the second time it's not as awkward, and then you continue until you become good at it, and you stop letting you know, the stares and the gazes frame you. I mean, you have to start learning to frame yourself and valuing your gift and valuing what you have to bring to the table. So, you know, when we talk about what's awkward and what's weird, I reflect, it just hit me like this term, the Great Society. We know that has a certain meaning, but I feel like our Great Society is when people are, when our society or our community, when everyone within that space is acting within their own gifts. When that happens, then you have a great society. You have this symphony playing, because I'm thinking, if you and your wife are both running to fix the toilet, like, who's writing poetry and who's singing music and who's doing the other things that matter, because everything matters.
Yes. Yes. No, absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Let's talk about this, because we're kind of getting short on time, so I'm going to kind of skip around a little bit. One of your bylines is that is put a healer in your home. Talk about that. What exactly do you mean by that?
It means taking control at the lowest level possible. Like, you don't have to blow your reactions out of proportion and kill a fly with a hammer, for example. So two things come to mind. Just like the scout motto, always be prepared.
Right.
And that's a very relevant mindset. So, for example, if medications is what you reach for at, you know, on a routine basis, just because you feel the sniffles coming on, then that might be overkilling. So what we do is teach you how to put your body in tune with natural courses. For example, I'll say, if you have a headache, you know, instead of reaching for an aspirin or medication, try breathing in some peppermint. Same thing with congestion. If you're having problems sleeping, instead of reaching for pharmaceutical, you can actually put lavender on your pillow and you'll sleep like a baby. Digestive issues can be dealt with ginger. So there are things that your body can notice and, you know, get down to the actual cellular level, so that some actual healing can go on and not masking of pain. And that's what we want people to do. And, you know, pain actually is signals to your body, and it's really a communication. So you don't want to hide it. You want to deal with it and help it to reconstruct and, you know, build a new platform.
It's interesting to me how much we simply don't know about how much we don't know. You just mentioned some things, some of these essential oils that have really, you know, they've been around forever, but they're starting to pick up a lot of popularity and a lot of, what do you call it? You know,
just momentum.
We call it, yeah, momentum. Thank you.
Even
support
yeah.
in the medical community. I know several doctors, MDs, if you will, who prescribe or support the use of essential oils to treat, like you said, stuffy nose,
mm-hmm.
you know, digestive issues. You don't always need to pick up a over-the-counter or prescription medicine. Sometimes that's probably,
right.
you know, a signal. Maybe if you're having some of these issues, maybe it's a signal that you need to look at your nutritional intake. What do you think?
Exactly. I think you're exactly right. And again, what I really do want people to do is to start communicating with their body, so that there can be, you know, ongoing dialogue, so that when there is a shift or even a twinge, you don't just mask it, you address it. and then you let that you have that constant dialogue because the body changes. I mean, I had an allergy one summer, and I've never had it. Hadn't had it before, haven't had it since. And, you know, you just have to be cognizant of those things. Otherwise, you end up, you know, reaching for things that are actually harmful to your body in the long term. And that's part of the challenge, too. We do things that we don't see an immediate negative impact, and we continue to do those. But over the long run, there's a price to pay. So, you know, we just want people to be informed and educated so that they can make the right choices for themselves and their home, their entire household. So, you know, we have things in my house. If my husband has a headache or, you know, someone has a challenge, you know, we reach for oils first. We do steam. There are a lot of natural choices that become our first ready response, if you will.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think that by doing this, we give ourselves the opportunity to be, let me use the word, stronger in a lot of ways, right? Army strong, if you will. No, I'm just kidding.
Absolutely. No, I'm not.
You know, because we become so lazy. We become, as a society, we become so lazy. I'm fat. Let me take a pill. No, work out.
Yeah.
Eat less. You know, I'm having problems with my digestive system. Let me take another pill. No. You know, again, try something different, essential oils. Again, check your diet. Stop drinking 4 or 5 Cokes a day. You know, I mean, there
absolutely.
Are things that, you know, that some common sense things that when you become more responsible, often, when you become more responsible for your health, you're not relying on doctors and medicine. Not to say that doctors and medicine don't have a place, but they shouldn't be your first call. Maybe they should be your second call or your third call, depending on the situation.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that because you're dealing with the physical side, which, you know, is very key. But the other part of that tripod, I think, is when you're looking at just that spirit and that you know, that who you are on the inside. So, you know, just to take it a step further, when we look at, let's just say, for example, reality TV, you know, is like a lot of vicarious living. So we look at things to be champions, and it's easy to sit back and look and you know, feel like we're part of the thing on the big screen. It's like, no, get out and exercise. No, strengthen yourself. No, make choices that'll help you be strong in the face of, you know, of an emergency, or even, you know, just walking and running and just having a strong mind, body, and soul. But you can't get it by looking outward. You have to start looking inward.
Absolutely. Be the what do you call it? The lead role in your own movie, so to speak.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think people are afraid to do that, and it's easier to, you know, to put on the jersey and pretend you're on the field. I'm not against sports, but, you know, I mean, that's a whole part of the issue of nutrition and health and wellness, because we're not acting, you know, we're not getting the fresh air, we're not taking the kids out and, you know, doing things on a regular basis. And then, you know, so in my shop, I have kids who come in with obesity issues, kids, you know, and it's really a setup for failure on a very large scale.
I love it. Listen, we are going to have to bring you back and talk more, Kim. I've enjoyed our time together and love your insights. Again, Kim Daniel, former U.S. Army captain, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing. Looking forward to having you back again soon. Merry Christmas to you and your family.
Thank you, Bud. I received that, and thank you for your time. Have an awesome, awesome day.
All righty. Good stuff there, guys. Just really enchanted with our guest, with my guest today. I hope that you enjoyed it as well. You know, we can, you know, take control of our lives. We can, deal with the gifts of let's say non-tradition, right? We don't have to be stuck in a label or a box, if you will. Most importantly, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.